Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the podcasts that are living over there while you're over there. Make sure you check out everything else that 1517 is doing. All the articles, the academies, all the videos that we've put out, all the events that we have. Check out all that stuff. You're going to find a lot of stuff that's going to be useful to you. And, of course, if this show is something that you regularly listen to and you consume other 1517 content, of course, consider becoming a supporter of that content. You know, it's all free. All the stuff we do is free. And it's not free to make, turns out, because, you know, everything costs money. And, you know, these days, Chad, I don't know if you know, but everything costs more money than it used to.
I've noticed that. Yeah. Strange the way that works.
Yeah. It's more, it costs a little bit more, or in some cases, a lot more. But anyway, so that's true for everything else, everything that we do as well. But if you want to help fill in that gap, you can go over to the donate page or click the link in the show notes to donate, and you can become a supporter and help us keep doing what we're doing. And we appreciate all the people that do that. All right, Chad, we are in Job 21. We got about, halfway through this thing. And Job is in the middle of a rebuttal. Yeah, his rebuttal is pretty straightforward because he's had to make it a couple times now. And, you know, once again, the response was, hey, you know, bad things going to happen to the wicked people. It always does. Look around. Look at how bad the wicked have it. And Job's response is pretty much, you look around. What are you talking about? Like, who are you talking to? Right? What world are you living in? The wicked do, in fact, prosper. You're out of your mind. And we kind of about halfway through that response.
Yeah, and speaking of halfway, as we were discussing right before we hit record, we are halfway through the book of Job.
That part's kind of wild because this is one of the things that's true about Job. As you're reading, especially this part, which is like, this is the bulk of Job, is this discourse like this. As you're reading it, like if you got to this part, you'd be like, surely this is over, about over.
Like wrapping up any minute.
Like how much longer can this go on?
Yeah, well, you know, anyone who's sat in on many theological debates knows that they are rarely short. So this is definitely the theological debate book of the Bible. So we got a few more chapters to go, even though there's not going to be a lot of new things that are said, especially by Job's friends. Job has a few more things to say.
I feel like one of the things that you could maybe, because you're doing chapter by chapter, and this is taken, you know, we're doing this over the course of weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks. But you have to understand that, like, this conversation, like, Job's friends get there, they hang out for a couple days, you know, like it's, they're chilling. But this is all presumably just, like, a really one long, frustrating day.
In fact, I used to, a few times, so I live in East Texas now, but when I lived in Central Texas, I would hike in a park called Purgatory, and I would listen to Job. I just figured it was appropriate. And on some of my long hikes, I'd be out there for 2 hours, and I could listen to the entire book. So, yeah, you can listen to Job in 2 hours. So, you know, this conversation could have taken place over a day, or it could have been multiple days. But anyway, yeah, it's taken us weeks to get through it, but it wasn't like this was a 6 month dialogue between Job and his buddies.
Yeah, they weren't like leaving, coming back. I mean, at least we have no evidence of that. Maybe it's over the course of a couple of days. We have no evidence of that either. Like it seems like it's just once they start talking, it's on. And you're like, man, this is one heck of a conversation going on here, man. Like this, and maybe that's why maybe you can start hearing the tone get more and more frustrated. I mean, this is just, they're probably getting hungry. They're probably arguing right through lunch.
Mm-hmm. No, yeah, they're hangry now, so it's getting worse.
Yeah.
So yeah, Job 21:17 is where we left off, and he's kind of in the middle of this rebuttal, where he's pointing out that things are not as his friends have suggested. It's not like The wicked all are cut off in the prime of life and suffer the fruits of their evil deeds. So he's picking up here with verse 17 by saying, how often is it that the lamp of the wicked is put out, that their calamity comes upon them, that God distributes pains in his anger? So you're claiming that the lamp of the wicked is put out all the time. They're cut off. Well, show me some evidence of that. When does this happen? When does calamity come upon them when they're in the middle of all their evil doing?
I think Job's argument too is like, because he does it, how often is that? Like, the argument isn't that, like, yeah, bad things only happen to good people and bad things never happen to wicked people, or that wicked people always get away with it and they're never caught and they're never punished. The argument is that, like, there doesn't seem to be any sort of pattern to any of this, right? Like, Job's like, look, dude, bad things happen to good people. Bad things happen to bad people. Good things happen to good people. Good things happen to bad people. This idea that there's this hard, fast rule and you can know this, this, and this is just obviously not true. And so I can ask the question, like, how often does that happen? Like, and maybe you can come back and be like, well, I've seen it happen. I'm like, okay, but like you're arguing that it always happens, and that's obviously not true. Is that 25% of the time? Shoot, 50% of the time. Do you could tell me that 80% of the time the bad things happen to wicked people, and you'd be like, yeah, but that's still, 2 out of 10 times it doesn't, because I feel like Job's frustration is that there's not really a rhyme or reason for any of this that he can discern, right? It's like all seems pretty random and arbitrary.
Yeah, they have the friends have a very mechanical view of the universe. It's almost like a deistic kind of God, where he has set things up to where if you do X, Y is going to result. So if you do evil will happen to you. If you do good will happen to you. And they're holding to this naive understanding of the universe, despite the fact that we have example after example, like you were just describing, where that does not happen, where the wicked prosper and the righteous suffer. So that's, of course, that's one of Job's main points here. And he goes on to say, how often, verse 18, how often does it happen that they're like straw before the wind and like chaff that the storm carries away? You say, God stores up their iniquity for their children. Then Job refutes this, not refutes it, but says in response, well, let him pay it out to them that they may know it. Let their own eyes see their destruction, and let them drink of the wrath of the Almighty. For what do they care for their houses after them when the number of their months is cut off? So he first of all begins by quoting his friends, saying, "Well, you know what God does, really? He's gonna if it doesn't befall the evildoers in their own lifetime, well, then what's going to happen is God is going to just hold this punishment until they're gone, and then he's going to mete it out upon their children."
Yeah, and
And
Job's
Job
like, sounds
says,
like a pretty sweet
basically,
deal.
yeah, Job's like, well, what good does that do?
Yeah.
If God wants to make a point, then let him pay it out to them, that is, to the evildoers themselves. Let their own eyes see their destruction, and let them drink of the wrath of the Almighty. Because, I mean, if these are evildoers, what do they care what happens after they're dead and gone? They're
Right,
dead and
yeah.
gone.
Yeah, and you're talking about wicked people. It's like it's not like they like have they probably aren't the sort of people that have like are real concerned about what their children are going to do or anything like that. That's not what they're worried about. I mean, and also, I mean, for Job, I think that just hey, don't worry, Job. It'll be just if God doesn't get them, he'll get their children. And you're like, that. I mean, that doesn't sound just. Like, so what?
This does sound very just.
If somebody murders somebody and then you're trying to find him, you can't find him, you never find him, and then he dies, and then you find his son, and you throw him in the electric chair. I mean, what are we doing here? And you're like, and you say justice has been served. I don't think this is correct at all.
No. And of course, Ezekiel will make that same point that you don't punish the children for the sins of the father. Speaking of evildoers not caring what happens after they're dead and gone, even righteous King Hezekiah, I was just reading this morning in, well, it's recorded in Kings as well as in Isaiah. I'm reading through Isaiah right now, and it's that part where he's been sick, and the king of Babylon sends a letter, telling him, "Hey, I hope you get better." And then some envoys show up from Babylon, and Hezekiah takes them all through his stuff, shows them all his treasuries, all his things, and then Isaiah catches wind of this, and comes to Hezekiah and says, "Hey, who were those people, and what'd you show them?" And he tells them, and then Isaiah prophesies that what's going to happen down the road is that these Babylonians are going to come and they're going to take away all your things. And then Hezekiah, who is, one of the righteous kings, is like, "Oh, good, because that means there's going to be peace in my days." So he's not worried about what's going to happen to his grandkids or great grandkids or whoever. He's just happy that in his lifetime, everything's going to be okay. So even righteous Hezekiah isn't that worried about what's going to happen to his house after him. Much, much less are evil those going to care about that. So Job's point is, listen, if there's going to be justice, let it be done now before those who deserve justice are dead and gone and don't know what's happening. So
Job also might be like, you might be thinking like, was my dad like, maybe my dad was horrible. Like, am I just remember
yeah,
going about this
there's about my
wrong?
father I was unaware of.
Like, I can't think of anything I did, but like, good grief. That's how it works. I maybe have to go audit his life too and figure out if I'm getting punished for something he did.
So verse 22 picks up with this, and Job says, "Will any teach God knowledge?" So are you going to be the instructor of the Almighty here, seeing that he judges those who are on high? Is judging those who are on high, I assume, is reflective of other Old Testament passages which talk about God judging the heavenly hosts who rebelled against him. And you have that in several different places, Old and New Testament. So God is the one who judges those who are on high. So we're not going to become his teacher. Verse 23, one dies in his full vigor, being wholly at ease and secure. His pails full of milk and the marrow of his bones moist. Another dies in distress of soul, never having tasted of prosperity. They, so the ones that have everything and the ones who have nothing, they all lie down alike in the dust, and the worms cover them. So this is kind of Job wrapping up this part of it, saying basically, listen, you look around, and what happens? Well, you got some people who are the haves, and there's some people who are the have-nots. And Job describes the haves here as those whose, well, the Hebrew is uncertain here. If you check the translations, there's all kinds of translations of the first part of verse 24. But ESV has his pails are full of milk. Other translations have his sides are filled out with fat. I have no idea what this means, but the New Revised Standard Version says his loins are full of milk.
Oh.
Don't know how that works, but King James has his breast are full of milk. So some weird stuff going on here in the translations, but
This guy's got
they're
some
just
milk.
trying to
They
make
got
sense of
some
the
milk.
Hebrew. I think
They
we
got some
you
milk.
cap I mean you capture the essence of it. He's got a lot. He's not hurting, whether his pails or his body is full of milk. Well, he's not hungry.
Whatever that is, it's not as weird as saying the marrow is bones are moist.
Yeah.
What?
I guess if you get super, super hydrated, your marrow dries up. I don't know. It's
I was, yeah,
yeah,
dude.
it's a strange metaphors. But I mean, we get it in the sense of you got everything you need. You got all the milk you need. Your bones, your marrow of your bones are moist. You're good. You're rich. But another guy, he's got an embittered soul. He's never even tasted of this prosperity that other people have. But you know what? Job says, it doesn't really matter because they're all going to be dead. All of them alike are going to go down to the dust. And he has this nightmarish image.
Yeah, the
The
worms.
worms cover them. It's not as bad as listen to this parallel. This is from Isaiah 14. He's talking about how the king is brought down to Sheol, and he says, maggots are laid as a bed beneath you, and worms are your covers. So, I wouldn't read that verse right before you go to bed because your dreams are going to be pretty weird. But
yeah, you know, this is back in the day before caskets and whatnot, man. Like, this is just stick just you in a
the
in
way
a cave
decomposition
or,
works.
yeah, man.
Job wraps up this section by saying, and his main point is that the wicked aren't necessarily going to die in the prime of life. In the end, yes, they will die, and yes, so will also those who are presumably leading righteous lives. In the end, they all end up in the same place. Then he shifts gears. Verse 27. Behold, I know your thoughts. So he's talking to his friends here. Behold, I know what you're thinking. And I also know about your schemes to wrong me. I'm assuming he's talking about wrong verbally in the sense of maligning and accusing him falsely of having deserved the things that he's suffering. So I know what you're thinking. I know about your scheming. For you say, where is the house of the prince? Where is the tent in which the wicked lived? So this is reflective of, it's not an exact quote, but it's reflective of many of the things that friends have said that basically, hey, look for by prince. Prince here is understood to be a powerful one who abused his office. So where's this prince's house? Well, it is no more because God destroyed it. Or where is the wicked tent? Well, it is no more either because God has got rid of him as well. So that's what they say. And Job responds by saying, basically, have you been nowhere? are you unaware of anything happening in the world? Have you not, this is what he says, verse 29. Have you not asked those who travel the roads? And do you not accept their testimony? That the evil man is spared in the day of calamity, that he is rescued in the day of wrath. So, you know, even if you're unaware of this, do not talk to anybody, you know, the guys who travel around and have some experience of the world. Because if you took 30 seconds to visit with someone who has been places, what they're going to tell you is that when it comes to the day of calamity, the evil guy gets away. And when it comes to the day of wrath, he's rescued. He's let out from whatever danger he's in to rescue. That's the way it works, Job says.
Yeah, I actually had someone just yesterday ask me, like, do you think there's any, like I know, we're Christians and everything, but do you think karma is a real thing? And I was like, no, I don't think so. Because, there's certainly, if you're, there's, some reaping and sowing principles, maybe. I mean, if you're, nice to people, people will probably generally be nice to you, and if you're, good to be around, people will want to be around you more. If you're not, they won't. And there's some of that kind of stuff. It's just kind of natural. But I don't know if that's karma. And it seems to me, of course, I got Job on the mind for, as I know, we've been going through this forever and we're still in it. And it seems like some of what Job is talking about this too is that. It's like, it seems, though, that people that are sort of above and beyond wicked, the more wicked you are, the less it seems that, whatever kind of, thing you think might be, some form of karma exists, right? So, if you're, regular people, and you're somebody who is a gossiper, you might get a reputation as a gossiper, and people might stop telling you things or confiding in you, and you'd be like, "Ah, that's karma or whatever. You've earned this." But if you're running some kind of huge cabal and you're uniquely wicked person, you're putting out hit lists and all this kind of stuff. No, those people don't. Of course, sometimes, but it's not like that at all. Then you just have people fear you, and nobody will tell you the truth. And it's not. You're gonna have to wait for the day of judgment for most of that stuff. And it seems like that's a lot of what Job is doing here. Where it's look, man, we're not talking about your average wickedness, but the more wicked you are, the more likely you are to get away with it.
Yeah. when you were talking, my mind went to Herod the Great. I mean, and I know, for those who know Herod's story, yes, he died of a grotesque and painful illness. Yeah, sure. But you look at most of his life, and if you know anything about the atrocities of which Herod was guilty, you're like, that guy didn't go get what he had coming. Caesar once said that it was safer to be Herod's pig than his son. So, he was taking out people left and right. But for most of his life, he enjoyed. I mean, he had palaces all over the Holy Land. He had, everything that his heart's desire. He had pleasures. He was living an opulent lifestyle. So, I mean, he's just one example that we could multiply today. And
But
Job would,
what you
refer to that example of someone who's not getting what we might deem they justly deserve.
Yeah, well, if you think about, like, I mean, if you're running the cartel, I mean, I don't know, maybe you go die in some kind of crazy firefight or whatever. Yeah, you've got all these people that are afraid of you and that do whatever you say and like and all this kind of, it's like the more, because like it's sort of like extreme wickedness is usually tied with, it can or can be also joined to gaining more and more power. Because obviously, the more power you have, the more opportunities you have for doing whatever it is you want. And so some of this is like, okay, to say like all wicked people get what's coming to them, you're like, well, all powerful people certainly don't get what's coming to them, and a lot of powerful people are pretty wicked. That's how they got there.
Yeah, so you can understand Job's frustration with the claims of his friends. So after saying he's rescued in the day of his wrath, verse 31, and we're almost done with the chapter here, he says, "Who declares his way to his face? And who repays him for what he has done? When he's carried to the grave, watch is kept over his tomb. The clods of the valley are sweet to him. All mankind follows after him, and those who go before him are innumerable. How then will you comfort me with empty nothings? There is nothing left of your answers but falsehood." So he finishes up here by saying, these wicked that you claim are going to die and receive their just deserts early in life. Well, nobody, I mean, declares their wickedness to their face, and certainly no one's going to repay them for what they've done. I mean, they are all powerful, so no one is going to take the risk of doing that. And then verse 33, to kind of cap off his argument, he says, "Listen, even when they die, it's not as if they're tossed into a ditch and perish in obscurity. There's all kinds of pomp and circumstance around it, even with their burial." When they're carried to the grave, he says, watch is kept over his tomb. So we have a tomb, and people are going to be all around that, keeping watch, or extending reverence to them, or whatever it might be. This phrase, "the clods of the valley are sweet to him," presumably this is saying that it's like a mound or something over their body. That's how one commentator explains it. So, even the earth itself, in being heaped up over them, is sweet to them, paying homage to them. And then when it says all mankind follows after him and those who go before him are innumerable, that's the image of a procession being led to the grave. So even when they die, I mean, these people who had it so well, even when they die, they still have it well in the sense of they're being honored by all of these people. So then he finally says, basically, you guys are worthless. All you have are empty words, empty nothings. There's
Yeah,
nothing left of your answers but falsehood.
I like empty nothings. That's
I'm gonna start using that
it's
phrase.
very
Yeah, that's.
redundant, but gets to the point here. It's like, yes, you got a bunch of empty nothings. Oh.
Yeah, I do. I like that. I like that translation. So that's Job's argument. That's his rebuttal to the claims of his friends that the wicked are going to get their just desserts in this life and going to get it early. No, Job says, basically. So that's the end of Job 21. So it's somebody else's turn now. Job has had his speech, and now our friend Eliphaz is going to jump back into the rhetorical ring with Job. And this is it. This is his final speech. Even though we're halfway through the book, this is going to be Eliphaz is he was the first guy to speak to Job. And he's going to be now speaking for the final time. Chapter 4, chapter 15, and now chapter 22.
I do like
So
the
he's.
I do like the title of this one. I know I keep bringing them up, but the people that did the Bible headers didn't always do a good job. They did a pretty good job with Job. Maybe it's because it's pretty easy because it's the same thing over and over again. But this one, of course, says Eliphaz speaks. Job's wickedness is great, and so you're like, oh, shocker! He's going to talk about how wicked Job is. But part of what it is that after Job is saying all this. It's like if they came in to this situation thinking, man, I wonder, man, Job was a pretty righteous guy. I wonder what he did. At this point, they're like, man, this guy had us all fooled. I mean, this guy is, like, listen to the words this guy is saying. This guy's wickedness is out of control. And like, this is where Eliphaz is. Like, Job, you're wicked. Like, you have not confessed anything, but you've confessed everything. I mean, these words that you're saying, I can't believe how wicked you are.
Yeah, I appreciate this chapter because Eliphaz, he's kind of up against the wall, and so he has to just start making stuff up.
Yeah.
He's like, "Man, you Job, you're so wicked. Here's what I am certain that you have done these things. I mean, there's no other way to explain what you're going through except that you have engaged in these kinds of terrible things." And he's going to list those once we get to those. So, but he's gonna start out here by saying, "Can a man be profitable to God? Surely he who is wise is profitable to himself. Is it any pleasure to the Almighty if you're in the right? Or is it gain to him if you make your ways blameless? Is it for your fear of him that he reproves you and enters into judgment with you?" And then we'll stop there. That's through verse 4. So he's got a it's kind of an odd introduction here. What he seems to be saying is that, listen, Job, it's not as if your righteousness is going to somehow add to God. So can a man be profitable to God? He's profitable to himself. So it's not like your righteousness is going to add anything to God. He's self-sufficient in and of himself. So if you're Even if your ways are blameless, that's not going to be some kind of gain to God. And after saying that, he shifts in verse 4 to saying, "So is it because you fear him so much that he reproves you and enters into judgment with you?" And of course, the implication is no. It's not because you fear him. It's not because you have such awe, faith, reverence, hope, and love toward God that he's now entered into judgment with you. It's because of your evil. It's because of your sin. Now, the great irony here is that Eliphaz, unaware of what we know, unaware of that opening scene in heaven between God and Satan, does not realize that, yes, actually, the reason that Job is suffering so much is precisely because he fears God.
Yeah.
Eliphaz says, "Is it for your fear of him that he reproves you?" And we say, yeah, kind of. I mean, that's what started all this.
Yeah, I
Job
mean,
was such a righteous guy that Satan said, "Oh, yeah, well, you know, the reason he's so righteous is because you've been so good to him, but make his life miserable, you know, curse you to your face." And God said, "Okay, go for it. Let's see what happens."
well, here's like Eliphaz like says sort of one thing that's right, which is if you're blameless, does God gain anything? Does this like add to God? And of course, the answer to that is like, well, no. I don't add anything to God. But he starts out with something wrong in verse 3, where it says, "Is it any pleasure to the Almighty if you are in the right?" Well, I don't know. Like at the beginning of this, God seems to be like the whole thing that happens here is that God brags on Job. It seems like he's taking pleasure in, at the very least, sort of ribbing the devil about how great Job is. So it does seem like he's taking some pleasure in it. Like he does it. He was sort of reveling in how good of a guy Job was and rubbing the devil's nose in it. And yeah, so nah, man. Like, yeah, yeah, it seems that God does like that sort of thing. Now, it's not adding to him. It's not making him. He's not gaining something. He's not gaining. He's not without something if he doesn't have it. But does he take pleasure in it? It would certainly seem so.
Well, yeah. I mean, we have Ezekiel saying, or God saying through Ezekiel, I don't take any pleasure in the death of the wicked, but rather that he turn from his evil way and live. Well, that means that God does take pleasure when the evil man turns from his way and lives.
Yeah.
That's what pleases God. So, yeah, I mean, God is pleased. We're in the right because we're doing what is imitative of him as those who are created in his image and likeness. So we do what's right. That means that we're doing what is the will of God.
This is kind of a weird theology that he has, too. I mean, you don't see this every day, where the argument here is kind of that, listen, if you do all the right things, if you are a righteous person, God doesn't care. He only cares if you're a sinner. It only works one way. He's just like neutral. Like it's almost like if you were righteous, then he just doesn't concern himself with you. God is like, and maybe this is a common theology, but God's eyes are like roaming to and fro. And what he's really doing is just looking for sinners. If he's righteous, he'll just skip over you. Like he's not going to concern himself with you. Only thing he's interested in is where the sinners are, and so that he can pour his judgment out on them. So there's no pleasure in like repentance or righteousness or anything like that. Like he's just like, well, that's what you are supposed to do, so I won't punish you. But God is really just like, it makes God seem very capricious, right? Like where it's just like, who am I going to pour my wrath out on today?
Well, it's kind of with an apology to all of those in law enforcement out there. He kind of portrays God as a policeman. You know, a highway patrol does not pull me over and walk up there and say, sir, I just want to thank you because I noticed that you were, you know, keeping it in your lane and you were going the speed limit. I see you're wearing your seat belt too. Just wanted to thank you. That's not the way things work. He pulls you over. It's most likely because you've broken the law. So that's kind of the way that he's portraying God, that God is like that. He's only looking for lawbreakers. He's only paying attention to lawbreakers. And law keepers, well, he just kind of ignores because that's not his prerogative. Yeah, it's a very very negative view of God.
Yeah.
So he has postulated that it's because of Job's lack of fear that God is reproving him and entering into judgment with him. And so he has to go on now with this whole string of accusations against Job. Now, keep in mind, as we hear these, that we have zero evidence that Job has committed any of these things. And in fact, we have an abundance of evidence that Job has done the exact opposite. But again, as we started this chapter out, pointed out that Eliphaz, basically, according to his own logical or theological system, has to claim that Job has done these sorts of things because in Eliphaz's system, there's no other way to explain why Job is suffering what he is. And so here's what he says. Verse 5, is not your evil abundant? There is no end to your iniquities. For, and here he begins his list. For you have exacted pledges of your brothers for nothing and stripped the naked of their clothing. You have given no water to the weary to drink, and you have withheld bread from the hungry. The man with power possessed the land, and the favored man lived in it. You have sent widows away empty, and the arms of the fatherless were crushed. Therefore, so here's his logical conclusion. Therefore, you know, since you've done all these terrible things, therefore, Job, snares are all around you, sudden terror overwhelms you, or darkness so that you cannot see, and a flood of water covers you. So there's his seemingly airtight argument. Here's what you've done, Job. We know that you've done it. We have no proof, but we are sure that you've done these things because there's no way to explain what you're going through. And therefore, ergo, All of these snares and terrors and darkness and floods of waters are afflicting you.
It's pretty. That's
Job's
pretty. That
quite the sinner.
It's pretty wild. Like these, because these are like, you know, you move from like your speech is too lofty, Job. Like the way that you talk to God is, how is it any wonder that he hates you? I mean, look at how you speak of him and all this. To very specific things that you've done, right? Like these are like, yeah. Yeah, dude, and there's zero evidence. In fact, all the evidence you have in the book, I mean, start at the beginning. Like, well, if Job was doing all this, how is it that God's like, have you checked out Job? And how is the devil not? Would the devil's response not be, have you checked out Job?
Like, yeah, have you seen what he does to the widows and orphans?
Yeah, come on, what is going on
that
here?
That thirsty guy that he turned away one day,
like. Makes no sense at all that God would be like, check him out. And the devil's like, hey, you check him out. This guy's a mess.
Yeah. So I do think it's interesting that all of these sins are horizontal. He doesn't say anything about, you know, he's blasphemed your name and he has trodden your word underfoot and he's refused to worship you and blah, blah, blah. All of these are things he's done to his neighbors. This is all kind of a, you know, second table of the law stuff, lack of, it's a sins of a lack of love with regard to the neighbor. In particular, the neighbors who are in need, you know, yeah. the powerless. Yeah. So he's exacted pledges of his brothers for nothing. So rather than, you know, taking care of his own family, he's exacted pledges of them. And this language, verse 6, of stripping the naked of their clothing. Of course, that's the irony. If you're naked, you have no clothing. But basically, from those who have nothing, he's even taken what they have is the idea.
Yeah.
Of course, I mean, it's basic biblical love to give a drink of water to the thirsty and to feed the hungry. I mean, that's Matthew 25 stuff, right? You know, when I was thirsty, you gave me water to drink. When I was hungry, you fed me.
I mean,
dude, nothing more basic
need,
than that.
You don't even need... There's some of this stuff is like you have to be like uniquely wicked.
Human decency, right?
Yeah, like you don't even need to be a Christian to be like if somebody's like dying of thirst and you'd be like, yeah, God, I'll give you some water. What?
Right. Yeah, it's just it's common human behavior.
Right, you don't typically need like you know Jesus to well up inside of you and be like, I feel compelled to not let that person you know die of thirst. Anybody's going to do that. You know? So
yeah,
you're like, man,
I'm pretty sure if I was super thirsty and I came across an atheist, he's not going to be like, nope, sorry, no water for you, buddy. Yeah, of course he's going to give me some water. Verse 8 might be a little bit strange when it says the man with power possessed the land, the favored man lived in it. The Hebrew is kind of interesting here. The man with power is the man of arm, because arm is a symbolic of might and power. So the powerful man possessed the land, and the favored man in Hebrew is the man with uplifted face. So these favored and powerful men, they possess the land. And the implication is the needy people, the poor people did not. So took the land away from them. Widows were sent empty away, and the arms of the fatherless were crushed. I learned something this morning. So the Hebrew word here for fatherless is often rendered orphan. Now, if we talk about an orphan today, we in our modern society mean a child who has lost both his parents.
Right.
But in the biblical world, you can be an orphan if you've lost your father, because the father was the one who was to protect you, to look out for the family, of course, all of those things that the fathers did and do. And so the ESV in rendering this not orphan but fatherless is actually done well. It's because orphans, we tend to think, has lost both parents, but an orphan in the biblical world is simply one who has lost especially his father.
The image you get here is like some orphan reaching out his arms to you, and you crush, like, instead of giving him something or helping him or grabbing onto them, you crush them. You're like, that's pretty wicked.
Yeah, it's the, I mean, this is kind of the escalation that you see often in biblical poetry, where the first line is, well, the widows, he just sent, you know, empty, sent them away empty. He didn't give them anything. And the next line heightens it. He's like, yeah, when the fatherless stretch out the arms, he didn't just like send them away empty. He crushed their arms. So, you know, all of this together is what I mean, it's really nothing more than slander, honestly. He's making up things about Job, and then coming to the conclusion that this is the reason that Job is suffering what he is. So one more case where the friends seem to be so frustrated now that they are just making up things in order to making up lies and accusations in order to support their claims against Job.
Yeah. Well, Eliphaz is not done. He's got more to say, but we're going to have to get into it next episode. He will continue, and so we'll join him for that. Chad, I will see you next week.
All right, see you then.